I use spring water to make tea, and it tastes better than tap water. When I make espresso, I also use spring and mineral water because it makes the coffee taste better. I don't use milk and sugar, so I know what I'm tasting. It's totally true. It looks like I've got a lot of humble pie to eat this afternoon. Looks like I was laughing at the quality of water issue, thinking that it really didn't make a difference, and looks like I'm absolutely wrong. Looks like it absolutely does make a difference to the coffee or the tea or whatever it is that you are drinking. Karen says, absolutely loved the 4:30 song. It's given me goosebumps. It is exquisite, and I want to agree with you because I think it is too. Gail E. weighing in this afternoon saying, what about Jerusalem, Master KG? And should any of your listeners be on Twitter, there's nothing stopping them messaging messaging President Trump to ask him to donate to the station. I don't think so, Gail, but that's a nice thought. You say, I'm not on Twitter, otherwise I would have. Rene says, I relate completely to what your guest is saying. I also believe that water is not water. When I was very much younger, I used to drink straight from the tap. It was the sweetest water I've ever tasted. In those days, South Africa had the best water in the world. So you see, I'm not my sugar filtering my bottled water. Well, Rene, I think you completely are, but I say that with absolute love. You say you relate perfectly with a guest. I even cooked with bottled water. And then just two more notes very quickly. Carol says, anything by Yaakov Shweki is great. Excuse the spelling. And I like drinking distilled water that you put into your car battery. Oh, no, you can't do that. And then finally, Unsigned says, anyone who thinks water is water has never tasted how awful a particular brand is. That is amazing to me because I didn't think that there were differences in bottled water. Time check for you. It is 20:05, and I am told that my next guest is on the line, and we're going to be speaking to Brigadier General Dr. Ephraim Lapid. I want to discuss this issue of extremist Jewish attacks on the West Bank. And Dr. Lapid, are you with me? And if you are, great to have you with me on Chai FM this afternoon.
Welcome. Sorry that we have to speak about an internal case without an enemy, internal case of Jewish minority. We insist to call them a minority, hopefully that they are still minority, because everyone, at least even the leadership of the people in West Bank, the Jewish population in the West Bank, the leadership of them also protested to this very ugly action. This is anti-Jewish norms and values, and against law, of course. And also against the interest of we as a state, we want to keep as much as possible the common life in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank. And such events put break the routine, and also paralyzed the units to deal with a non-issue. It's the involvement of this brutal young people is against everything that I can see from an Israeli point of view.
Dr. Lapid, I think back a couple of years already, and I seem to remember warnings way back when from the Mossad and the Shin Bet talking about Jewish extremism being an issue. Was this problem just ignored because it was politically expedient to do so?
What we had a tool in the past, and a few years ago we had a tool of administrative detention.
Yeah.
And there were some dozens of young people, from my point of view, it's extreme Jewish terrorists, that we were unable to put them in jail by law. So the tool was administrative detention, something that we used and we still use to different Arab people who are not totally covered by a certain evidence, but we have some highlights, some in hints about their involvement with terror. This was also relevant to Jewish youngsters, and Minister of Defense Katz deleted this opportunity, and this make a very big a very big obstacle to the military units dealing with these terrorists. So if you speak about the comparison of the past, this is a big change.
Who are we talking about here? Is it Nara Givot? Is it the Hilltop Youth? Is it them who we are talking about? Or is it other groups that we don't even know about?
We have a lot of information, and I still don't understand personally. I don't understand how a case with involvement of some dozens. Every case is not a unique person or one or two persons. It's 10, 12, 15 people, and whenever the army come, and they immediately, of course, escape. And the fact that we are unable to stop them, it's a very very big upset.
What in your opinion are the ideologies behind the attacks? What is their end game?
Their ideology is that to hit sovereignty of, there's not sovereignty, but what they call sovereignty of the Palestinian Authority is a way to maintain the ability to stop the ability of establishment of Palestinian state. This is the, let's say, the big target. But if they hit some cars or some caravans in Arab villages, or they hit the olive fields, these are actions against any interests of us, and of course the stability of the area.
The cycle of violence just continues and continues. I don't for one minute want to come across as somebody who's supportive of what these Jewish extremists are doing. It just is interesting that the Times of Israel is leading with a story right now as we speak, and I'm going to read you the headline. Man stabbed to death in terror attack at Gush Etzion Junction, three others wounded.
Yeah.
With these sort of ongoing attacks, you kind of at least begin to understand the motivation of what the extremists are doing. Again, I'm not apologizing for one minute. In fact, I think it's counterproductive and against Israel's interests. I'm just trying to understand why they're doing what they're doing.
Exactly. Of course, the terror continue with its intentions. We have to cope with it, and we do almost what we can from operation point of view. What the Jewish minority, I say Jewish minority, yes, what they act is means that we have to devote certain numbers or certain number of soldiers to
sure.
deal with them
sure.
instead of dealing with
the real issues. Yeah, no, I hear you 100%. I'm interested from a legal perspective as well. You say that the motivation is to affect sovereignty, Palestinian sovereignty in Area C, I think you said.
Yes.
Do Palestinian security forces have the right to apprehend Israelis who are, say, caught red-handed perpetrating these attacks?
From our experience, I don't remember any case that Palestinians detained or arrested such persons. I think that they limit themselves because they understand that our feedback can be much better. So that's my assumption.
Final question for you this afternoon on this particular issue. Do you think, given the current political situation, the force, the extreme pressure being put on Israel by America to abide by the ceasefire, etc., will cause some movement by the Israelis to clamp down on Jewish extremism?
Formerly, the IDF had to criticize such a trend because we need the superiority of the Israeli Air Force in the area. The superiority is not a question of prestige. It's from an operational point of view. We Israel, the little country Israel, we cover the Middle East in Iran, in Yemen, sometimes in Iraq. So these ranges need, of course, very good intelligence and very good operational superiority of our Air Force. When I say we, I mean the IDF especially, from its point of view, it is not a political point of view, it's only a military operational point of view. They are sure that giving the Saudians such abilities can cause us damage. You know that many decisions, many political decisions take risks. And even in Israel, from a political point of view, wanted to support President Trump in its policy, and it means that we take risks. The IDF has to say what are the risks and what is his not ideology, his policy. His military policy, the political echelon has naturally wider considerations.
Dr. Ephraim Lapid, thank you for enlightening us this afternoon. We're going to leave it there, and I've got no doubt that we'll catch up pretty soon.